This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. We'd like to acknowledge their ongoing connection to lands, waters, and culture, and that sovereignty was never ceded, and that colonization and genocide are ongoing processes that continue to this day. This always was, and always will be, Aboriginal land.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Auspol Snack Pod, the podcast where we would usually serve you up bite-sized chunks of Australian news and politics with a side of crispy memes, and then we'd tell you that we're also the official podcast of the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group. But this week, we're going to do something a little bit different, and next week's going to be a little bit different as well. We're pre-recording these so that we can take a little bit of a break, but, you know, we didn't want to starve you for content. So what we thought we'd do is kind of interview each other a little bit, just have a bit of a loose kind of free-form conversation about, like, I guess how we sort of developed politically. So this week, I'm going to interview Noon and ask him about how he kind of ended up where he is, I guess.
Maybe you could tell the listeners what your name is as well, because you haven't done that yet, even though if you're listening to this and you don't know who we are, maybe you should go back a couple episodes.
This is going to suck for you. Yeah.
I mean, welcome to the show. Welcome to the... Enjoy.
Yeah. You, it's great. It's yeah, I'm Zach Lesnack. I'm a mod on the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group. And today with me in the studio, I've got a very special guest. Eno Funkenstein, a.k.a. Noon, my friend and confidant and member of my inner sanctum, frequent occupier of my inner sanctum. So, yeah, I guess, you know, eventually I want to make my way around to asking you, like, how and why you started the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group, because that's kind of why we're here. But I thought, yeah, it'd be fun to just kind of go back and, like, even... I don't know how relevant you feel it is, but anything that you think kind of from your childhood that you consider to be kind of formative. I mean, obviously, we definitely take the view that, like, your social and economic and material context is very important in shaping kind of how you people develop politically. So, you know, as much or as little as that as you feel comfortable sharing, I guess, is kind of an important part of the picture to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean... What was the kind of political environment you think you grew up in as a kid?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, my family are, I would describe them as progressive. My mum is a progressive Jew, and I think that that informs a lot of her feelings about social justice. She's a feminist. She did a lot of, she was a social worker and now she teaches meditation. But she, when I was a little kid, she was doing social work and in particular doing community medicine with First Nations communities. I remember we went out to a community just outside of Alice when I was about 5 or 6, and that was really formative for me. And on my dad's side, his parents were communists, sort of like card-carrying 50s Stalinist communists. And so, yeah, I guess those are the two kind of like family contexts that have led to me developing the way that I have. That, yeah, both my parents are progressive and compassionate and politically engaged. Yeah, so I think that's one thing. Mm. I think sort of the major like psychological impetus that I had for I guess like my current political stance is my experience at school. So I went to a hippie primary school that was like Steiner-esque. It wasn't actually Steiner, but it was that kind of thing. It was really loving and open community, and we you know, it was a, I think they called it a child-oriented democratic learning environment, which is about right, you know, like...
That sounds like a Herald Sun cartoon poking fun at hippies.
Yeah, totally, yeah, yeah. But, yeah, it was a great school, and, you know, we were involved in decision-making, we could decide what curriculum we were going to look at, we...
Oh, that's very cool. Well, yeah. From what like, years of school were you there?
So I think I started in kindergarten till year 6.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and there is a preschool attached that I went to a mainstream preschool before I went there.
But sure, that's like a significant portion of your education.
Totally. And it's really empowering. And although the teachers are kind of like have this hierarchical status to some extent, they really go out of their way to not be like that as much as possible. Mm. I remember once actually, I must have been in, you know, year five or six. So, you know, towards the end, but we had had a school meeting, which we had every week. And we, the student body, had voted that we were going to basically abolish class timetables and that the teachers would just like put up a like their timetable for the day and everyone could just go to whichever class they wanted to the whole time.
Right.
And it was like passed with overwhelming numbers. And like the principal, who was really like an administrator, not the principal that you see at other schools, sort of was like, really sorry, we'd love to do it, but the school will be deregistered. And we nearly fucking rioted because it was like, what the fuck, you like overturning the will of the people.
Wow. Okay. But this, I mean, it's all coming together now. This is all making a lot of sense.
Yeah. And then I went to high school, which is how we met. Actually, we met in science class, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Right.
But there was a mainstream high school where over the course of about 3 years, I realized that I hated it and that it was crushing my soul and individuality. And later I found, you know, in the last couple of years, I found this great quote from Michel Foucault. Is it surprising that prisons resemble schools, hospitals, barracks, factories, all of which resemble prisons? And the answer is no, it's not surprising. So that was really my experience of high school. And then I dropped out. But I think that that contrast between this like open, caring, empowering institution of my primary school and then the like dehumanizing, soul-crushing bureaucracy of high school, I think that contrast has been really formative for me in my feelings about authority, individualism, activism, and like dignity, I think was something that I found lacking in high school that is something that's really important to my values now of treating people with respect and dignity and self-determination on all levels.
Well, if you give people that, you can't run a very efficient institution.
I guess that's true. All right, take it back. Prisons for all. That'll be great.
Were you like politically active in high school, like did you go to protests or were you kind of reading about like politics and social justice? Were you following politics in any way, shape or form?
Basically no. So I was part of a Jewish organization. It was a youth movement that was very progressive, though Zionist and environmental, though sort of in a liberal kind of way. I mean, smaller liberal sort of way.
They were like they were vegetarian as well, I remember. We'll kind of get into this a little bit later, but you were vegetarian in high school. And that, like, I mean, I would argue that's a political stance.
Totally, yeah.
It was definitely a moral one. And I don't know if there's any point kind of distinguishing between those two things particularly.
Definitely. And I think, the vegetarian was actually really significant for me, and I did get that through that Jewish organization. But they also, we were involved in a bunch of other stuff. So there was a group called Youth Against Genocide in Darfur, or Yagid, which is the most Jewish fucking sounding acronym that you can get without actually being a Yiddish word. And so I was sort of, not very actively, but I was involved with Yagid. So we did protests throughout the Sydney CBD. This was much earlier than that, and I was kind of dragged along by my parents, but I went to the Iraq War marches.
Yeah, I remember going to that one as well.
Though that wasn't like my decision exactly, but
you know, the fact that your parents were taking you along to political, like A, that they were going, and B, that they were taking you.
Totally.
That's not nothing.
Yeah. And I do think that this youth movement was empowering in terms of thinking critically about like how states are acting and about what kind of impact that we can have on that. And, this organization, we were very proud to be progressive. And now as a sort of like far left Marxist radical, I'm like, they weren't that progressive. But I do think that that was empowering to see that. And we, this was sort of after high school. I went to live in Israel for a year as part of a...
I was going to lead you there next.
Cool.
Because just from the perspective of me as your friend, I feel like that was a bit of a watershed moment for you. At least that's how it seemed. Because you were like kind of basically like practicing Jewish in high school.
Yeah.
And very involved, like your main kind of like community was the Jewish community via this youth group that you were part of. Then you went to live in Israel for a year and you came back and you were basically like, yeah, I'm not really Jewish anymore.
Totally, yeah.
Which is huge. And this was your first year out of high school.
Mm.
And this it's called Shnat, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a thing that the youth group does. Sort of kind of like a slightly more hippie version of Birthright, is that correct or not so much?
Sort of. So a lot of different groups do Shnat, and so Birthright is like a 2-week program basically, and Shnat Yisrael is the full word, which means like a year of Israel.
Right.
And Shnat is like a year of. It doesn't quite make sense by itself, but
sure.
So it's a gap year program. And the idea is that you're a sort of participant in the youth movement up until then. And then you go away for a year, you get trained how to run the youth movement, you learn all about Judaism and about how great Israel is and how there's no genocide going on. And then you come back to Australia and you teach that to all of the kids who are sort of coming up through the movement.
But vegetarian, so...
For real, yeah.
And the IDF is the most vegan defense force in the world.
Uh-huh. That is true.
I think also the gayest... At least that's what they do. They position themselves as LGBTQIA+ friendly.
There is a lot of pinkwashing in Israel.
Pinkwashing, greenwashing.
I think that was actually really important for me. So in the first couple of months of the time in Israel, I sort of won't go into a big discussion about what all the different segments were, but we were basically doing like full-time study about how to run youth movements, about what Israel's like, and about how cool Judaism is and all this sort of stuff. And we had this class that's called Hasbara, which is a Hebrew word that's normally translated by Zionists as Israel advocacy, which I translated as propaganda, which is a more accurate translation in my opinion. but we
could just fucking record that soundbite, and if anybody ever asks me what you're like, I just play that for them.
So that was really fascinating. You know, we practiced things like, okay, you're in parliament and someone says that the slaughter of Palestinians is bad. You have 4 minutes to respond. Go. And we would just have to be like,
wow.
Well, you see, the thing is, Israel is great and all Palestinians are terrorists or whatever. You know,
like, it's fucking intense.
And overt as well.
I'm starting to get the sense of why you came back being like,
You actually said something quite, I think, insightful, which was that when I was a practicing Jew when I left, and when I came back, I was kind of like, I'm not that Jewish anymore. I guess you'd say I'm secular or non-practicing Jewish. But that at that point in my life, the religious aspect was kind of more important than the political aspect. Mm. And I want to give a shout out to a friend of the show, listener Nathan, who was basically my best friend while I was in Israel. And he was sort of a hard-headed atheist kind of dude, and had a lot of very gentle chats with me being like, yeah, so why do you believe in God? And kind of like not being like, that's dumb and wrong, but just kind of like questioning me. And I remember having this moment. I was at a festival called Zorba Habuda, and I was out in the middle of the Negev, the Israeli desert, in the middle of the night looking up at the stars. I was listening to Harry Potter 6 on audiobook, and I remember being like, this would all make just as much sense with no God.
It's all still here.
So I guess the atheism kind of came first, and I was an angry atheist for a long time, and that was kind of fundamental to my politics. And the sort of anti-Zionism came secondarily of being like, oh, there's this religious group who have made this state for their own benefit, and maybe I shouldn't be involved in that or supportive of it. And then later I kind of became more understanding of like the colonial aspects and that sort of, I guess, the more overtly political and less religious aspect. But I do think that the becoming an atheist was sort of an important part
for sure.
of that recipe.
And I think it's actually kind of a trend, really, that young men in particular, I think, judging by what I've kind of seen across the internet, come to their first kind of political awakening through atheism.
Mm.
And because, atheism is kind of to a certain, like, it's not apolitical, but it's not necessarily affiliated
totally.
With one political viewpoint or another. And what you see, and this is kind of a trend, basically looking at who have emerged as major right-wing voices on YouTube. Which, like it or not, it's actually a really important political marketplace. That's not a bad, that's not a good, you know, what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, that's a, where a lot of people get their kind of first political, that's where they start to engage with politics is on YouTube, and particularly the right wing pundits. And a lot of those big right wing YouTubers like Sargon with a cat started off as atheist YouTubers.
Yep, yep.
And that's what they first started talking about. Yeah. So it's, there's, sorry to speak over you.
Go for it.
Just the, I guess that, that first bit of major critical thinking and finding an identity in kind of taking a philosophical or moral position seems to be a kind of gateway into thinking about this other stuff. And interestingly, it can take people either left or right, depending on who is there to talk to them. And unfortunately, the right, as we know, is winning that war at the moment. They're really good at radicalizing young men who kind of looking for more of a political identity. But sorry, what were you saying?
Just, I saw a tweet that was like, everyone who was an atheist in 2012 is now either a like trans communist cat girl or a right-wing YouTuber. I can't remember exactly, but yeah, no, it's pretty true. Yeah.
That's 100% the vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
But I actually think something that was really crucial in my developing beyond that atheism into a more kind of like sophisticated political awareness was when I was living with you and our friend Lewis. And I don't know, I think I was talking to both of you about this. It was,
this was,
2011, 2012?
It would have been 2010 that we moved in together. No, sorry, 2011
in Israel,
that we moved
2010,
in.
Yeah,
yeah, so Noonan and I and our friend Lewis lived together in a share house for 2 years.
For a couple
years.
Of years, yep. And I remember at some point being like, you know, terrorism is because of religion or something along those lines, which is a standard new atheist kind of line. And I think it was Lewis who was like, so why did September 11 happen to the World Trade Center, not a cathedral? And that really fucking blew my mind because I didn't have an answer. Because if it was a religious issue, they would have been attacking religious sites. And in fact, it's an economic and social and political issue. And that's why they attacked the World Trade Center, which is this like icon of American financial hegemony, which I didn't really have the language to think about then at the time. But I think that question really put me on this path towards Marxism and like historical materialism, which...
Damn, shout out Lewis.
Yeah, thanks, Lou. Yeah. Fucking pro-cop motherfucker. No, he's not. We just like to make
fun
of him about it.
He's a little part of this. Go on. We'll have him on one day.
Yeah.
Yeah, so at this point, you have just started studying at uni. You're studying linguistics and philosophy?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And how are you finding it? What are you kind of, what are the ideas that are engaging you at that time?
I mostly fucking loved it. It was such a nice change after high school to be like learning in an environment that gave me a certain amount of respect and autonomy.
Wow, that made you feel good?
Yeah,
about
it's
yourself?
Wild, hey, yeah. Yeah, it was a bunch of stuff. I did a really interesting unit on climate change that then basically led me to volunteering with Quit Coal and Friends of the Earth in Melbourne and then Lock the Gate doing anti-fracking work. And I was doing that for maybe 2.5-3 years, something like that. Some of that paid mostly as a volunteer. And that was really phenomenal. And so, you know, that's how I learned basically everything I know about climate change and about fossil fuels and also about community organizing. I spent a lot of time out in rural Victoria talking to people in little towns, which I think is a really valuable political experience, especially for, you know, inner city latte sipping lefties like myself to go and like talk to some people who aren't like that. So yeah, that was really valuable and made me kind of appreciate, the power of community organizing.
Because the result of that Lock the Gate campaign was a 5-year moratorium on fracking in Victoria,
which is ongoing, has been extended.
And which is like a huge win coming from, you know, it was a totally grassroots campaign.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm like, remember being aware of you working on that stuff at the time, and I wasn't really doing anything of the sort.
To sort of answer your question, I don't think university necessarily... I mean, there was a bunch of stuff I loved. I fucking love linguistics and syntax. It's like fun word games. I love doing cryptic crosswords, which I like to say is applied morphology, which is a very niche linguistics nerd joke if anyone's interested. But yeah, the philosophy was great as well. I remember you know, there was a lot of fascinating stuff in it. I'm a fan of the Epicureans, if anyone out there cares about that. But I remember I'd come home
picking up anything you're putting down right
that's
now.
That's fine, yeah, yeah. Well, I was going to say, I'd come home when we were living together and I'd be like, oh, I just learned this, you know, fascinating theory about monads or whatever and, like, you know, explain it. And Zach or Lou would be like, uh-huh, and why does that matter or should I care? And I'd be like,
it's fun.
but it's cool. yeah.
You know, like... Everybody likes dumb, meaningless stuff.
Yeah.
Some of it's just more complicated than others.
Yeah.
that's maybe being a bit rude to linguistics.
No, I think dumb and complicated is about right. yeah, but I mean, I think the philosophy degree informed my, like, political development to an extent. I was talking about ethics. I was talking about political philosophy. Mm-hmm. I wrote my first essay about Marxism, which I remember showing to someone I had a crush on at the time, and they were like, this is really badly edited, which was embarrassing. Yeah, I'm going to deliberately not find that essay and reread it, because I'm sure it's terrible.
That's probably wise. So you identify as a Marxist.
Yeah.
That's what you said you uh-huh. are.
yeah, yeah.
So I guess, I mean, you like, it seems like you started to basically come to that understanding in uni. Do you want to talk a little bit about what being a Marxist actually means to you and sort of how you came to identify as one?
Yeah, sure. To answer the second part first, It's a pretty recent thing, actually. I think I graduated in 2014, 2015, mm-hmm. and I probably didn't actually call myself a Marxist then, so it's only been in the last 3 years or 4 years that that's really kind of been a thing for me. And it came because I read a book by Lenin called The State and Revolution, which is possibly my favorite bit of political writing, political theory.
Is that why you keep trying to give me your copy?
I don't have a copy. I keep borrowing it from people. But you should read it. It is a little dense. I'm not, like, it's not everyone's cup of tea. And Lenin, you know, he's writing for his contemporaries who he assumes everyone reading it knows what he's talking about already.
Yeah, right.
So it's not necessarily the most accessible, like, intro to political theory. Mm-hmm. But I found his model of what a state is very convincing. And I guess up until then, I'd probably called myself an anarchist or, like, a libertarian socialist or something like that. Mm-hmm. And reading this book by Lenin, I was like, ah, there are, like, fundamental structural reasons why we need a more sophisticated response than, like, anarchism. Which I may get flamed by. If anyone has hot takes on this, I'm totally willing to talk to you at more length about how Lenin is actually an anarchist. So what does Marxism mean to me, or what does being a Marxist mean? So I guess the first or most important thing for me is materialism, which is a kind of a loaded word. It's sort of a Marxist jargon thing, but basically it means explaining things through, like, fact rather than ideas. That's a kind of a biased way that I'm explaining it, but for example, so the opposite of materialism is idealism. And so an idealist view might be something like, at some point everyone realized that the divine right of kings was not very sensible, and so they all decided that we were going to change into a parliament-based system. Something like that, right? So that's an idealist explanation. There was this idea that came along and changed things. The materialist explanation is something like, there was this class of aspirational merchants who were becoming richer, but the divine right of kings was, like, getting in their way of becoming more rich and powerful. So they overthrew the government so that they could have their power unopposed. Mm. So that's a materialist explanation where it's people's, like, economic and social and political power and relationships that are relevant, rather than, like, this great idea that someone comes up with.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the first and most important thing for me. And I slip into idealism all the time, and it's a difficult habit. But I think that materialism is the most valuable tool that we have analyzing the history of humanity and the present.
Mm.
Yeah.
Actually talking about the lived reality of people's lives from, like, an actual physical perspective.
Right.
As opposed to just talking about ideas and theories, or yeah, I guess understanding, like, social change as a result of, like economic conditions. Would you say that's another?
Yeah, yeah. So the famous quote from the Communist Manifesto is something like the history of hitherto existing society is the history of class struggle.
Yeah,
and so that's this idea that the like power relations between different groups of people is what drives change in political organization and technology and economic development and so on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the other major aspect of Marxism, from my point of view, is a commitment to what I said before about compassion and dignity, is that, you know, I've worked a lot of jobs and went to a school where I felt like I was being dehumanized and treated as a non-being who just needed to be a number. You know, we need to get you passed and out of school. We need you to make 800 coffees today. And there, like, Marxist analysis is really useful for uncovering the fundamental reason why people who work, who sell their labor for wages, are always being exploited.
Mm.
And there's kind of this like really neat mathematical explanation for that. And so I guess there's something really I felt seen, I guess, by Marxist theory, because the dry economic textbook that he wrote 300 years ago reflects perfectly my experience of being a wage laborer. And yeah, so I think those are the two main aspects of Marxism for me is compassion for people who are being forced to destroy their bodies and minds and relationships to buy a house to live in or to buy food and so on. Yeah, so I think those are the two main fundamental components of Marxism that are important to me as far as I'm concerned.
Cool. So you started Auspol shitposting how long ago now? 3 years?
3 years. Three and a half.
Three-ish.
Like, yeah.
And the description at the top of the group says, people were really sick of me shitposting about Australian politics on my timeline, so I made this group. And it's true, you were like, back when I actually used to like go through my, like actually like scroll through Facebook, it was like 50-60% just Noon posting blurry, low-res photos of articles from The Age that he thought were interesting.
Yep.
And that kind of stuff. And didn't you have friends like threaten to unfriend you?
Yeah, yeah. Specifically my friend Lani, who I'm still friends with, but I don't really speak to anymore. I don't think she listens to the show. But thanks, Lani. You really set me on this path.
Yeah. So you created Auspol shitposting as a place to put all your shitposts. And I mean, it's grown pretty steadily since then.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I guess, do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, as the admin of it as well, it's not just you created the group and then, let it run free or whatever. And what, you know, whatever happens will happen. You do keep a pretty close eye on what happens. The group has a very specific, I think there's a certain shared understanding of kind of politics. Obviously, it's a strongly leftist group. And you have in large part helped guide that, I think. And great job. I really appreciate it. It's my favorite place to hang out on Facebook. The only place I hang out on Facebook, really. But yeah, I guess, do you want to talk a little bit about how, like what it was like when it started and how it evolved and how it's kind of informed your own political development in over the last like 3 years?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know if I really have any specific ideas about how it's affected me. I guess the main one is this podcast, you know? Like, it's weird that, you know, the shitposting infrastructure that I've built up over the last couple of years, you know, I've got Auspol shitposting, but I've got like 60 other groups and pages and shit, most of which are extremely unpopular. for some reason, irredentist memes for regionally autonomous teens didn't catch on. I didn't know why.
Heat death memes.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
For entropy loving teens.
Yeah, yeah. Can someone tell heat death it's either pronounced het death or heat death and that it can't be both? Yeah.
Yeah, that was the group that lost half of its membership at a consistent rate.
Yeah, but, you know, I think it's been really exciting over the last couple of years to discover that other people are interested in the same things and have similar approaches and also would like the internet to be a, like, caring community rather than a vicious, like,
fire hose of garbage straight into your eyeballs.
And, like, you know, we get a little bit of that in Auspol shitposting, and every now and again someone comes in with an earnest question and they get dog piled on. And I'm like, this isn't really the vibe I was going for with the group, but also everyone's having fun except Op. So, you know, whatever.
I think for the most part, people kind of rein that stuff in. We have had provocateurs.
Yeah.
Shout out Henry, who I'm sure is not listening to this. But, I mean, yeah, he provided a lot of entertainment.
Yeah.
But, no, I mean, I think that aside from the political perspective, you've hit on something really important, which is that you have tried to foster, and we have as a group tried to foster, an actual sense of community. And that's why I think people are passionate about the group. They do defend it, and they are interested in preserving that spirit of kind of, I don't know, I guess, as you say, treating each other kindly and actually being a place for conversation and discussion to a certain extent, you know, like people coming in with extreme right-wing views could just like...
get banned, that's fine, yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. You need to like, and this is what we've talked about before, preserving the, or like riding that line between making space for people to develop and also making sure that spaces are safe for people to exist in.
Totally.
And that can be, you know, it's a hard line to walk, but, you know, I think you're pretty good at having those honest conversations, I guess, and telling people, like, we don't like this for this reason. I'm going to leave the post up so other people can see this. You know, I'm not going to boot you out or whatever, but have a think about it before next time you post. You know, that's the kind of thing that actually does encourage people to change their behavior, I think, as opposed to just a ban.
Getting flamed or whatever,
to be clear, some people absolutely deserve.
Well, I think... you know, this week on Ospol Ship Posting, I posted some blurry photos in classic Noon style of the Xenofeminist Manifesto, which I'm medium on. But it talked a lot about how the digital space had this promise of equality and openness and community and all this sort of stuff. And instead, it's become this, like, corporate capitalist hellscape. Mm-hmm. And that there needs to be some concerted strategic plan to undo that, basically, and to make the internet the thing that it could be for all of humanity. And it's maybe a bit pretentious to kind of connect that to the group, but I think that that's what I have inadvertently been trying to do, is create this community where people feel safe and respected and engaged and valued, and where they're safe to ask questions, and where they're safe to make dumb jokes, and where, you know, everyone's going to treat them with dignity. So I think that has been a really nice thing on Ospol Shit Posting. And, you know, I scroll down my newsfeed and I see fucking all these pages tearing each other apart about bullshit and everyone getting angry at Trotskyites and this fucking bullshit I just can't be bothered with. And it's really nice to have a group that isn't like that, and where people go out of their way to be nice and respectful to each other most of the time.
Yeah, I think for the most part, it's true.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, and I think the other thing, the flip side to that equation, to a certain extent, is it's also a place where it's safe to kind of express your anger and frustration to a certain extent, and that it's a place where it's acknowledged that sometimes anger and frustration is the appropriate response. It's something on the internet that I don't think people hold a lot of space for, because there is so much kind of naked, pointless aggression and like deliberately hurtful stuff being said, that often when you kind of see that tone being taken, you might just be like, oh, you know, here we go. It's just somebody like rage tweeting again.
Okay, boomer, I'm out. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, especially for like for people in who, you know, kind of like politically or socially marginalized in some way, that like anger is an appropriate legitimate response to that. And I do think that there is, like, that's one of the things I like about the group, is that you can have those kind of angry conversations, but they're still productive.
We talked about it at the time, but after the climate strikes, I was feeling really disheartened, and there was a really fascinating conversation in the group about what we might do about that, and so on. So that was really nice to feel supported. There was one other thing about the group that I just wanted to touch on that's been really nice, is that we've had a couple of real life meetups. We've had drinks for the last couple of elections. And
the last one was extremely dark.
Yeah, it was. We got our fucking champagne confiscated that someone brought in to celebrate if Tony got out, and the pouring glasses, and the bartender came in and was like, you can't bring in external drinks, which is fair, but you're a dead whatever, that's not important. But it's been really nice to meet these people in real life, and I hope we can keep doing that Yeah, and sure. This podcast is another way in which the shitposting group has affected my life in a really nice way. I get to come and talk to you every week, and I fucking love doing it. You know, I don't really care how many listens we get, because it's such a nice thing to be creating, and that would never have happened without, the group.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. Cool. Well, unless there's anything else that you kind of wanted to touch on, we've sort of run out the clock. We've done half an hour.
I think that's about it.
Yeah. I hope you guys enjoyed this little chat. There's going to be... Yeah, we're going to do this basically again in the opposite direction.
Yeah, me talking to Zach about his time in Israel. Zach has never been to Israel. That's a joke.
Yeah. I mean, look. If you enjoyed it, let us know. You know, next year's... Who knows what we're going to do with the show?
If you did like this slightly less newsy version of the show, let me recommend going to patreon.com/OzPolSnackPod. And if you support us for $1 a month, you get a bonus episode each month, which tends to be a bit more like this kind of thing, a bit more us having a chat about some stuff rather than sort of news.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. Thanks, Noon.
No worries. Thank you.
My pleasure. And to everyone else out there, take it easy. Keep on snacking in that old free world.
Crunch, crunch.